come out of this position and the sun will shine over the earth.
Just consider the situation. I think recently we had one instance of the solar eclipse, isn't it?
Yeah.
All across the world, that the people, you know, could not, the full view of the sun could not be obscured.
Yeah.
You know, when the full obscure of the sun is not available and the view is not over there, a dark, dark world is waiting for you. It would be very much frightening, I mean, without that. So without the presence of Imam, which is the source of the shining star, the world would not be a good place to live.
Very true.
That's right. So the people are all, I mean, the true awaiters are waiting for that shining day. That is the day of
and
the Zuhur.
It will definitely happen, inshallah.
Yes. And the reappearance of Imam Asmi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, inshallah. Thank you very much, Brother Ali Alevian, for a nice elaboration regarding this topic. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Last Savior. For more information, visit our website at parstudio.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of life? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest throne?
Paranoia hits major Western news outlets concerning an alleged Israeli strike on Iran as Zionists still struggle to fully comprehend the resonating Iranian True Promise operation that struck them right in the face. Now, the New York Times faces a backlash from its own staff over editorial policies they say have led to a repetition of Israeli entity propaganda and the censoring of Palestinian perspectives in their coverage of the genocidal war on Gaza. Meanwhile, 54% of Zionist illegal colonial settlers have lost all their faith in the invincibility of their occupation army, thinking their entity is now weak in the face of the entire axis of resistance, namely the Islamic Republic of Iran. Welcome to Exposé, the show that leaves no stone unturned. Interesting 2 weeks have passed indeed, ending up with a global mocking campaign against the alleged Israeli occupation's mini quadcopter counterstrikes in response to Tehran's weekend attack on April 14, as Western broadcast media still resonates with the Iranian True Promise operations against the Zionist occupation. Let us hear from Fuad Itayim, our broadcast expert, about it in Fake News Exposé. Zionist Israel is trapped. Wait a minute, it's not me who's saying it. I know you think that I'm biased towards Palestine, so of course I am, but it's according to all Western media, especially the broadcast one, as per this short clip.
In the Middle East, Israel continues to face threats on several fronts. Today, 18 people, including 14 soldiers, were injured in northern Israel after Hezbollah launched an attack from Lebanon. In Gaza, Israel continues its military operation against Hamas. The IDF says it is also transferring more aid to civilians. And then there is Iran. Israel still weighing how, when, and if it will respond after Iran's attack this weekend. Iran's president said even the tiniest invasion would be met with a, quote, massive and harsh response.
And Zionist Israel is yet to launch its promised attack against Iranian soil, or at least acknowledge that it was them will send these tiny quadcopters that were downed by Iranian air defense missiles. Now, Fuad, how was your trip throughout this broadcast media since the Iranian attack on the Zionist entity up until today?
Well, Marwa, I'll be very honest. I had to compromise on a lot of gold that I dug up from Western mainstream news concerning this record Iranian attack on Israel, but I eventually had to concede with the best out there. Mm-hmm. First, let's comment for 1 second on the paranoia and hysteria that hit Western news outlets after the Israeli response to Tehran's Operation True Promise on 14 April. Mm-hmm. This was a very weak and a very lame response to the hundreds of drones and missiles that penetrated Israeli air defenses that evening. Mm-hmm. According to Western media, this was Israel's form of limited response, which it reportedly carried out in order to avoid a wide-scale war. But it was so minuscule and so unimpressive that Iran only officially reported the sound of minor explosions and some suspicious drone-like objects that were intercepted by Iranian air defenses. Mm-hmm. Now, despite no official Israeli confirmation or acknowledgement of this attack, this is the frenzy Western media outlets like BBC were in.
There are fears of an escalation in the Middle East conflict after explosions were heard in Iran. Two U.S. officials have confirmed to our broadcast partner CBS News that it was an attack from Israel. State television in Iran has reported big explosions near an army base and airport in the central city of Isfahan, activating local air defense systems. Blasts have also been reported in the country's northwest.
So the attack supposedly took place at 5 a.m., but by 7 a.m., life was had returned to normal and all airports were operating normally. So you can imagine how insignificant this attack was.
It definitely.
Let's move on now to MSNBC, which reported right after the Iranian operation against Israel that, contrary to all later reports during the attack, even officials in the U.S. had no idea whether or not the interceptions were even working. Mm-hmm. And by the way, these interceptions were being aided by three nuclear-powered nations, the U.S., the U.K., and France, plus the Arab protective arm of Israel, the Jordanian government.
So much for the invisibility of Zionist Israel.
All about both the strikes and what the U.S. knows about Israel's plan for a response. What do you know? What did you find out?
Well, let's go through some of this, Alex, and I'm just going through my notes because this call just ended and it was just about, I guess, almost 45 minutes that we were on with these senior officials going through it. First of all, they said it was a very significant attack and that at one point in the Situation Room last night, there were more than 100 ballistic missiles in the air, and the president and his national security team did not know whether they had landed, whether they had been intercepted, because they were only minutes away coming from Iran towards Israel. Separately, I was talking to a senior administration official earlier this afternoon, who told me that all of the missiles and the drones and the UAVs that came from Iran were heading towards a military base, towards one military base in Israel. None went towards any civilian areas. There were other projectiles that did come from other areas, from Hezbollah, for instance, and from other Iranian proxies. But what was so unprecedented about this, of course, was that it was a very large, significant attack, an attack that the officials said intended to create significant damage.
So as you heard, Marwa, the initial MSNBC report just a few hours after the retaliation was according to U.S. officials in the White House and in the Department of Defense. Mm-hmm. And they both affirmed that this was a very large, significant, and unprecedented attack, and that they had no viable information on whether or not the interceptive projectiles, mm-hmm. which, by the way, were worth $1 billion, yeah. Had actually worked or not. So MSNBC wanted us to believe that the Israeli narrative that 99% were shot down, which even an Israeli analyst said was false. Mm-hmm. Let's listen to this.
Okay.
When both the Situation Room and the War Cabinet had been through these moments when they did not know if Israel's defenses and the combined Allied defenses were going to work because the ballistic missiles moved so quickly, mm-hmm. in contrast to the UAVs and some of the cruises. But those missiles moved so quickly, they didn't know whether they were going to strike. And in fact, what they've now discovered is that 99% were thwarted. They were thwarted, 4 to 6, they said, were thwarted by the Arleigh Burke and the USS Kearney, the two destroyers in the area, the U.S. destroyers. Others were taken down by fighter jet pilots, British and Americans, who were in the air. And then the majority of those ballistic missiles were taken down by the Arrow defenses, the air defenses of Israel.
Where do we start? It's like these people don't have calculators on their smartphones. I mean, 99% means that only 3 missiles landed, whereas Israel said itself that 15 missiles had made it through, at least 15, which would mean that 5% made it through. And there were only 300 missiles. Let's remember that. Iran fires 120% more than that during regular IRGC military drills. Mm-hmm. In any case, even an Israeli military analyst recently told the Hebrew newspaper Ma'ariv that the 99% percent number is completely wrong, and the real number is more like 84%. And we can't forget that that's with all the help of U.S. defenses and Patriot missiles and expensive toys, basically, that Israel gets from its friends. Now, later on during the week, MSNBC kept on emphasizing the Biden administration's demand that Israel not respond to the Iranian operation and consider the April 14 attack a win for the Zionists.
Top U.S. officials are worried that a potential Israeli response could provoke a wider regional war that the U.S. could be dragged into.
Joining us now is NBC's Richard Engel from Jerusalem, and also with us is retired four-star general Barry McCaffrey, an NBC News military analyst. Richard, fill us in on the latest from this Israeli war cabinet meeting.
So this is a fast-moving story. As of this morning, it seemed like the U.S. was getting what it wanted, that it had succeeded in convincing Prime Minister Netanyahu, with a call from President Biden directly to Netanyahu, not to respond, to take what happened over the weekend, quote, as a win, the fact that Iran fired hundreds of drones and missiles and that nearly all of them failed or were shot down, caused almost no damage in this country.
But how did Israel respond to these U.S. requests? I think the British outlet Channel 4's reporting about it was quite interesting.
Thanks for the advice and support, but Israel will make its own decisions. That was the message from Benjamin Netanyahu to his British and German visitors who came here to Jerusalem today. Now, they are now at a G7 meeting of foreign ministers in Italy, pushing for coordinated sanctions against Iran. But their calls for restraint do not appear to have stretched to Gaza, where the killing goes on unabated, or to the West Bank, where tensions have also been escalating. Here's our foreign affairs.
So basically, Israel cried and ran to the protection of the US, UK, and France
again,
as the attack on its colonial military base was taking place, but brushed off and ignored all requests to restrain itself and not retaliate against Iran. Because as Netanyahu said, Israel will make its own decisions. And Israel did retaliate, but it was so weak that you can't even consider it a response.
It's very funny, Fuad, considering that they run crying to the West, please help protect us. And then when the West says, just sit tight, stop causing any trouble, they say, no, we have every right to do so. It is honestly
genocidal behavior.
Definitely. Well, thank you very much,
Fuad,
for your analysis. Now, ladies and gents, we will move on to digital mainstream media. Since the beginning of the Israeli entity genocidal war on Gaza, support among Western nations for this blatant military assault has been nearly limitless. That might not be so shocking, but what is shocking is the neglect of their media's own supposedly sacred values when those who fund and control these Western media outlets believe that the actual narrative does not advance their own interests. Here is our digital media expert Julia Qasim with the latest on blatant Western media censorship in favor of Zionist Israel.
Thank you, Marwa. So several American digital and print media outlets are now facing this backlash from their own staff over clear editorial policies that have led to essentially a repetition of Israeli propaganda and the censoring of Palestinian perspectives in their coverage of the genocidal war on Gaza. So beginning with the scandalous expose about the New York Times, which instructed journalists covering Israel's war on Gaza to restrict the use of the terms genocide and ethnic cleansing and to avoid using the phrase occupied territory when describing Palestinian land. That is, Marwa, according to a copy of the internal memo leaked by the New York Times and obtained by The Intercept. So in a piece published by them on April 15th titled Leaked New York Times Gaza Memo Tells Journalists to Avoid Words Genocide, Ethnic Cleansing, and Occupied Territory, written by Jeremy Scahill, Ryan Grimm. The Intercept found that the memo, written by Times Standard editor Susan Wessling, international editor Philip Pan, and their deputies, offers guidance about some terms and other issues we have grappled with since the start of the conflict in October. Mm-hmm. So, Marwa, while the document was presented as an outline in maintaining objective journalistic principles in reporting on Gaza, several New York Times staffers told The Intercept that some of its contexts show evidence of the paper's deference to Israeli narratives. Mm-hmm. So you see, issuing guidance like this to, quote-unquote, ensure accuracy, consistency, and nuance is how the New York Times staff should cover the news about Israel's genocide in Gaza. It's considered standard practice by the likes of New York yep. Times, but the same guideline essentially becomes non-existent when it comes to reporting, say, the Iranian retaliatory attack on Israel, which exposes the double standards that are completely hypocritical of Western
Definitely.
Media.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to see the New York Times try to hide from this scandal when printing an opinion piece by Jody Ginsburg, who is also the chief executive of the Committee to Protect Journalists, mm-hmm. entitled The Israeli Censorship Regime is Growing, That Needs to Stop. Mm-hmm. So when someone goes over this opinion piece, you'd think that the New York Times is actually, you know, doing something good and insightful in highlighting the Israeli censorship of their military's ongoing genocide of Palestinians. But, of course, there's no coincidences here. Mm-hmm. This was just published one day after The Intercept leaks about the New York Times memo. It's obvious damage control, and it's reminiscent of calls by liberal media like Christina Manpour from CNN, mm-hmm. Making the tone-deaf claim a week and a half ago that there are no journalists on the ground in Gaza, mm-hmm. Despite the extensive coverage of Palestinian reporters, freelancers, and citizen journalists on the ground documenting anything, everything. Mm-hmm. So in this New York Times opinion piece, Jody Ginsburg states that the refusal to allow international media to cover Gaza from the life inside is just one element of a growing censorship regime that leaves a vacuum for propaganda, mis- and disinformation, and claims and counterclaims that there are extraordinarily difficult to verify independently.
Mm-hmm.
So she continues to criticize Israel, claiming that the occupation entity champions itself as a democracy and a bastion of free press in the region. But its actions, of course, tell a different story. And at the same time, it's evident a piece like this could run because it's repeating the same rhetoric of there being a vacuum open for propaganda while kind of glossing over the mm-hmm. presence of Palestinian journalists on the ground, essentially.
For sure.
But to her credit, she does criticize the actions of the Zionist entity's allies, too. She writes that Israel's allies, too, pride themselves on their commitment to a free press. The U.S., Britain, and other Israeli allies like Germany all loudly proclaim their commitment to a pluralistic and independent media. But their governments explicitly support news outlets that broadcast information into and about countries that censor and control information, such as Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, which is funded by the U.S. Congress. So it's evident also in the U.S. Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken's visit to Doha, Marwa, on October 13th, the first week of Israel's genocide in Gaza, mm-hmm. where he explicitly asked the Qatari Prime Minister Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Thani to turn down the volume on Al Jazeera's Gaza coverage.
Mm-hmm.
Put this in contrast to Hillary Clinton, who praised Al Jazeera's coverage in the onset of the...
When it's good for them, when it actually gives them credit for something that they want to see in their interest.
That they engineered.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
exactly. So according to Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, in an investigative report published on January 11, 2024, Hamdullah Baykar, entitled Blinken's Request to Censor Al Jazeera Against All American Values. This was definitely not the first time the U.S. government officially asked Qatar to censor Al Jazeera because mm-hmm. it's reporting a narrative against U.S. interests in the Middle East. So according to Carnegie, this blatant U.S. request for censorship is not an individual case when it comes to Al Jazeera and their coverage of the Middle East and wider Muslim world. So following the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, the administration of former President George W. Bush allegedly pressured Qatar to close down, privatize, or censor the channel.
Wow.
So this proves that there is a precedent, Marwa, and while the Biden administration has not used explicit military force against the channels reporting on the genocide in Gaza, they have turned a blind eye and enabled the Zionist entity's killing of journalists and their families in Palestine. not only in Gaza, but also in Lebanon.
Mm-hmm. And provide them with the weapons to do so, actually.
Unconditionally.
Exactly. And then turning a blind eye to when the world says that this is a war crime and they do nothing about it. Anyways, thank you very much, Ms. Julia Qasim, for telling us about this expose and the scandals that come out of the Western print and digital mainstream media. Thank you very much for your time and contribution. Ladies and gents, stay tuned, because next we have Social Media Expose. As expected, the Iranian strike on Zionist Israel, dubbed True Promise Operation, is still reverberating on social media platforms amongst both supporters and opposers of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Here's our own Seema Itayim, social media expert, with the latest.
Thank you for having me, Marwa. It's been surreal. So social media users in Iran, particularly those who support the axis of resistance, of course, mocked the attack as a measly response to the roughly 300 missiles and drones that Iran launched at Israel last weekend. Then we move on to Hadi Nasrallah, who took it home, as usual, with his on-point posts.
As usual.
Saying Israel went from beating seven armies in 6 days to sending paper drones and nagging online about being bullied, LMFAO. Safe to say Israel has been deterred.
Yeah, safe to say that.
Now we move on to some ex-posts by those who are still hinged on the unprecedented Operation True Promise, which shook the Israeli regime to its core for the first time in a long time. So we begin with Harun Kimani, who posted, Iranian Sejil ballistic missiles and Sumar cruise missiles have taken out all Israeli F-35 fighter jets when they hit the Nevatim Air Force Base. Number one, each F-35 costs $136 million, and they were 36, meaning $4.9 billion loss in one night. Number two, Israeli government has acknowledged that Iran targeted military sites only. Civilian sites were not targeted. Number three, the much-touted Iron Dome was blind to the incoming Iranian missiles. Number four, the Sejil missile is so fast that it can travel from IR to IL in less than 10 minutes. Next, we have a post by Saeed, who mocked Israel's response by posting, time it took them to release satellite images from Iran, 12 hours. Time it took them to release satellite images from Israeli terrorists, 5 days and still pending. If you have a brain bigger than a hamster, you know exactly what's going on here. Shabbat Shalom, Israel. And then the cherry on top, of course, was posted by many accounts, including Mint Press. Here we have Mint Press's post, who posted the video by Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian in New York when asked about the operation, the response.
Foreign Minister, any comment on last night's strike? Will Iran retaliate?
What strike?
So Mint Press captioned the video, Iran mocks Israel. It was quite a classic moment. And, you know, he was asked while in New York if there would be a response to Israel's attack, to which he replied, what strike? And the minister's assistant sarcastically replied to that.
So basically, it was a week where people were mocking the Israeli entity's strike and then recapping what happened on April 14. I mean, Twitter, in specific, X platform, X is an amazing place to be when you're at the like a cliff of a World War III. It's a bit entertaining. Thanks a million for being with us.
Thank you.
Seema, to tell us about it. Now, ladies and gents, stay tuned, because next we'll be talking about figures expose. A recent survey by the Hebrew University of Jerusalem found that 52% of Israeli occupation settlers were opposed to a retaliation against the Islamic Republic of Iran for fear that it will further fuel the cycle of regional tensions. Now, the Hebrew University survey was conducted between April 14 and 15 by internet and telephone and sampled 1,466 men and women representing adult Israeli entity settlers. Now, the Israeli entity public's opposition rose to 74% if this counteroffensive were to jeopardize security alliances of the Israeli entity's allies. Hence, the mini quadcopters stroke. When asked if Zionist Israel should launch an attack against the Islamic Republic of Iran, 52% opposed the attack, while 48% approved of it. Asked further about the response Zionist Israel should take, a quarter of the 48% of who supported a counterattack said it should take place on Iranian soil, with 88% disapproving and 12% approving. And only 1 in 3 were in favor of a strike against strategic nuclear sites, with 67% disapproval rate and 33% approve. Also questioned on their perception of Zionist Israel's strength against Iran, 46% of respondents said that Zionist Israel is strong, compared to 27% who thought it is weak, and another 27% estimated it to be neither strong nor weak, making it a swooping 54% who have lost all faith in the invincibility of their own occupation army. Now, let us move on to the most notable expose voices for this week. Now, TikTok went wild last week as the United States of America vetoed a draft resolution at the UN Security Council which recommended granting the state of Palestine full membership in the United Nations. The veto by Zionist Israel's main political and military backer had been expected ahead of the vote. However, it did bring Palestine ambassador to the UN Riyad Mansour to an emotional speech. Here's Mansour's voice by Viary Video.
We will not disappear. We love life, to live in freedom and dignity in our national homeland.
Now, our aggravated voice for this week was by Eric Warsaw, who said that acts like this undermines the United Nations as an assembly and makes the U.S. come off as just plain ridiculous.
So this is breaking news right now. The United States just used its superpower veto to not allow Palestine membership into the United Nations. That is absolutely ridiculous. Everybody has the right to sit at the United Nations, to speak, have a voice, and vote in everything. This is an abuse of the superpower veto. This is completely unnecessary. Every group of people has a right at the United Nations to speak and be heard, everybody. And really, it's of no interest for America to be even doing this. It doesn't benefit us. It doesn't hurt us. We should be completely neutral to this topic. We're only doing it because for AIPAC, for Israel. And that's what makes it even more ridiculous. Acts like this undermine the United Nations as an assembly and as an effective group. It makes the United Nations less effective, and it also makes America look bad.
Now, ladies and gents, with that, we conclude our expose for tonight. Stay tuned for more eye-opening investigations on Expose. The truth is just a revelation away.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the United States, following David Pecker's testimony, Rhonda Graff has been called to the witness stand to comment on Donald Trump in Trump's criminal trial in New York. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Prosecutors in former President Donald Trump's criminal trial in New York called 2 new witnesses to the stand on Friday, 26th of April, rounding out the first week of testimony in the historic proceedings. Rhonda Graff served as Donald Trump's executive assistant and a senior executive at the Trump Organization for decades. Stationed outside Trump's office in Trump Tower, she handled his phone calls and schedule, engaging with those coming and going from meetings. Testifying for less than an hour, she told the court that she maintained a list of Trump's contacts, which included entries for Karen McDougal and Stormy Daniels. Both women claimed they had an affair with Trump and were paid for their silence before the 2016 election. Donald Trump has denied the allegations. Ronna Graff also said she had a vague recollection of seeing Stormy Daniels waiting in the reception area of the 26th floor of the Trump Tower. After Graff's testimony, prosecutors called a bank executive named Gary Farrow, who worked at First Republic Bank. He testified that Michael Cohen, Trump's former personal attorney and fixer, was his client when Cohen wired $130,000 in hush money payments to Stormy Daniels as attorney just days before the 2016 presidential election. Their turns on the witness stand came after the conclusion of testimony by Donald Pecker, the former publisher of the National Enquirer. Over the course of 4 days, Pecker detailed his involvement in a catch-and-kill scheme to acquire the rights to damaging stories about Donald Trump and keep them from public view, saying he did so to help Donald Trump's campaign. David Pecker testified about several meetings he said he had at Trump Tower, including a 2015 meeting where he said he agreed to be the eyes and ears of the Trump campaign. He said that arrangement led him to pay $150,000 to Karen McDougal, a former model. Donald Trump has pleaded not guilty to 34 felony counts of falsifying business records. The charges relate to reimbursements to Michael Cohen for the $130,000 hush money payment. Gary Farrow is a type of business described as a custodian of records. He's on the stand to testify to the accuracy of a series of records relating to Michael Cohen's bank accounts and transactions with First Republic Bank. Prosecutors have alleged that Michael Cohen used a shell corporation with a First Republic account called Essential Consultants to pay film actress Stormy Daniels. On Friday, 26th of April, they also showed formation documents for a limited liability corporation created by Michael Cohen called Resolution Consultants. That account was created for the payment to Karen McDougal that was never posted. Gary Farrow, who now works for a different company, was Michael Cohen's banker. He said he was assigned to him after Cohen's previous private banker at the firm left in 2015. I was told that I was selected because of my knowledge and my ability to handle individuals that may be a little challenging, Gary Farrow said, adding later that, frankly, I didn't find him that difficult. Farrow said Cohen called him if it was something that was urgent, but mostly walked to a branch across the street from Trump Tower to conduct his own business. Farrow said that Michael Cohen told him he worked for Donald Trump. Asked if he mentioned Trump frequently, Farrow said, yes, he was very excited to work for him. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the story and tells us more. The former tabloid publisher David Pecker's testimony in Donald Trump's criminal trial on Friday, 26th of April, presented a granular look into a hush money scheme which prosecutors allege was meant to sway the 2016 election in the real estate mogul's favor. But when Trump's longtime assistant, Ronna Graff, was called to the witness stand, her testimony humanized the trial, reminding the courtroom that at its core, these proceedings center on a film actress called Stormy Daniels, as well as a man who's either flawed or fraudulent. A key moment in prosecutor Susan Hoffinger's questioning of Ronna Graff revealed that Trump's contacts contained an entry for Karen McDougal, along with that of someone else called Stormy. Susan Hoffinger asked if she saw Daniels at Trump Tower on one occasion. I have a vague recollection of seeing her in the reception area of the 26th floor of the Trump Tower, she said. To the best of my knowledge, this was sometime before the 2016 presidential election. During the cross-examination of Ronald Graff, defense attorney Susan Neschels worked hard to downplay Stormy Daniels' presence at Trump Tower. Neschels cast Donald Trump as a man who was so busy that he maybe wasn't paying enough attention to business records, the alleged falsification of which prompted the prosecution against the former president. I vaguely recall hearing that she was one of the people who may be an interesting contestant on the show, Ronald Graff said when asked whether Stormy Daniels was being considered for a slot on Donald Trump's television program, The Apprentice. I can't recall a specific instance where I heard it. It was part of the office chatter. Susan Neschels asked, "You understood that she was there to discuss being cast for The Apprentice, correct?" Graff replied, "I assume that." Neschels then had Graff describe how Donald Trump would occasionally sign checks while he was preoccupied or multitasking. The line of inquiry seemed aimed at establishing that Trump was simply distracted when he signed checks now under prosecutor scrutiny. With David Pecker, defense attorney Emil Bov's questions on cross-examination prompted him to in effect say that coverage beneficial to Donald Trump was business as usual, as the former president's legal team tries to chip away at the prosecution's claim that there was an illicit conspiracy to sway the 2016 presidential race. David Pecker was instrumental in coordinating three hush money payments that were made during the 2016 election campaign to quash negative stories about Donald Trump. In cross-examination, on his fourth day of testimony, David Pecker was grilled by Emil Bov about whether he benefited from running positive stories about Donald Trump and negative stories about other politicians even before the alleged catch-and-kill scheme. Pecker testified that the Enquirer ran negative stories about the Clintons as part of an effort to help Donald Trump's campaign, agreed in a meeting in August of 2015. Asked if there were negative articles before that meeting, David Pecker said, "That's correct," and he agreed that it was because it made good business sense for the National Enquirer to run articles about the Clintons long before he did so on Donald Trump's behalf.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray five times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, and my guest this week as always, Sheikh Javid. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Assalamu alaikum, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, we, you know, started a series of episodes regarding the jurisprudential laws, you know, about praying in the mosque based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. And we'd like to continue our discussion with Sheikh Javid along the same line. Well, what are the things, Sheikh Javid, that can be done within the vicinity of a mosque? And what are those things that cannot be done?
Very good. Well, first and foremost, obviously, the mosque is a place where one should engage in worship, in prayer. So as long as the prayer is going on, nothing else should interrupt the people offering their prayers. Even if it, when it comes to, like, for example, teaching Islam, teaching Quran, and maybe teaching Islamic ethics, and these are these things which are very Islamic, okay? Mm-hmm. But when there, when the prayer is going on and there are prayers, people offering prayers, one should not violate their rights. One should not disturb them in any sense mm-hmm. of the word or so. So that is quite understandable. But then when it comes to what we can do in the vicinity of the mosque, of course, there's no problem whatsoever in having, for example, Quran classes, Dars al-Quran, Dars al-Akhlaq, okay? And, you know, the teaching practical laws of Islam, Ahkam, and, you know, practicing, acting, like, for example, engaging in reciting dua, and things which are Islamic in a sense, in its nature, you see. But I told you that it is obligatory to show appropriate respect for the status of the mosque, for the sacredness of the mosque, and the position that the mosque enjoys. And of course, it's not permissible to annoy or disturb people offering their prayers in that mosque, because they have the ones, they are the ones who enjoy the first and foremost right to offer their prayers. And if the time for prayer is passed, or maybe there is no one praying, you can start reciting the Quran, reciting dua in loud voice, or doing any other activities.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, and stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to praying in the mosque based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini with Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, when I asked you about the things that could be done in a mosque, I'd like to ask quite a relevant question. Could individuals, have their marriage ceremony in a mosque?
There is no problem. It is permissible because marriage is a recommended act, and it's not, there's no objection to someone getting married in a mosque because if it is, for example, you solemnize the marriage contract in the mosque, it is all right. No one has said that it's forbidden, okay, because in a solemn gathering, you recite the nikah, and then the two sides are married to each other, and then they leave the mosque without committing or perpetrating any other haram act, like for example dancing or singing illicit or unlawful songs, which one should avoid under all circumstances.
Right.
Okay, as far as the marriage contract and the solemnization of the marriage is concerned, it is quite permissible to take place in the mosque.
I see. Sheikh Javid, I ask this question because people oftentimes see funerals in the mosque only.
Yeah.
and you know, the Holy Quran being recited, right?
Yes.
And there is nothing to be worried about when it comes to funeral and sad yes. and solemn ceremonies. Yes. But when it comes to marriage ceremonies, there it comes with this territory, something like, you know, as clapping and being happy about it, you know, and dancing and stuff like this, you know.
Islam is not opposed to being happy, okay?
Right.
In fact, Islam encourages Muslims to be happy, to enjoy themselves, but one should use the lawful means to be happy.
I see. Okay. Well, you know, there's this question, Sheikh, I would like to ask you about it, and that is, what about using loudspeakers in the mosque, like to play, for example, the adhan for the individuals, the neighbors, those who are living nearby, to know that this is the time to prayer?
Well, His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei is of the view that there is no problem in broadcasting adhan in a usual and common way by means of a loudspeaker to announce the beginning of the time for prayer.
Right.
There is no problem. But there is a problem in broadcasting Quranic verses.
Mm-hmm.
Supplications, dua, and the like, using a loudspeaker in the mosque, because especially when it annoys the mm-hmm. neighbor, okay, mm-hmm. and often it does happen sometimes, because of course we see that some mosque, even in Iran, for example, and I have been to many other countries, of course they use the loudspeaker to play, for example, one chapter of the Holy Quran. And it takes 1 hour, 2 hours.
Yeah.
It goes on, and the loudspeaker is so loud, and it annoys.
Yes.
There are people suffering from illnesses. They want to have
rest
calm,
and quiet.
Yeah,
you know?
Quiet. So, in the event that it annoys the neighbors, His Eminence says that it is problematic.
I see.
But of course, when it comes to azan, it's permissible, because mm-hmm. azan is. Intended.
Only azan is allowed.
Is allowed.
Through the loudspeakers. Nothing else.
It's problematic when it annoys, you know, the condition. One should take notice of the condition. When it annoys
I see.
The neighbors, okay, it is problematic.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's take another break, and then we'll come back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
اللهم صل على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And shortly with our guest speaker, we are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to praying in the mosque based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, you know, all sorts of individuals go to the mosque,
yes.
and sometimes the kids or the babies, and the babies may actually, you know, somehow contaminate
yes.
The mosque due to their conditions, right?
Yes.
Well, if a piece of mosque, a piece of land in the mosque, or the carpet or whatsoever which is basically found in a mosque, becomes impure, ritually speaking,
yes.
like najis. So what should be done regarding that?
Well, it is necessary to note that it is haram for an individual to defile the mosque, mm-hmm. okay? For example, making it impure or transferring something impure to the mosque is forbidden.
Right.
So it is haram to make, for example, the ground of the mosque, the ceiling of the mosque, the wall and the roof of the mosque impure.
Mm-hmm.
And if they happen to become impure or najis, as you used the term najis, one should purify them right away without any, you know, leaving any gap, you know. And it becomes a collective duty, wajib kifai. For the Muslims, for people going into the mosque, to take quick action to purify the mosque, mm-hmm. you see. And whoever does it, whether the person who himself has made the mosque impure, or any other person who comes to know that the mosque is impure, it becomes obligatory for him to take a quick action to purify the mosque. Okay, that is it.
I see. Okay. Well, if a mosque is destroyed,
yes,
you know, for any reasons, and it's leveled to the ground, is it still considered a mosque or a masjid? And is it necessary to avoid making it impure ritualistically?
Well, His Eminence Karan Ayatollah Khamenei says that if a masjid or a mosque is destroyed or abandoned, and another building is constructed on it, on the very land, or maybe no sign of being a masjid remained due to being abandoned, okay, see? So it is a kind of dilapidated place, yes, with no sign of any masjid, and no one has even tried to renovate that place.
Yes.
So there's no settlement or village in the vicinity, of course, or nothing to indicate that this is a mosque, of course. His Eminence says that it's not certain that it is haram to make it najis, okay? So His Eminence is of the view that it is possible to be permissible when there is nothing to indicate that it is a mosque, okay? Because the ground, it is level to the ground. There is nothing, there is no village, no settlement around it. And of course, it's such a dilapidated place that, okay, no one believes that it's a mosque. His Eminence says that it's not certain, okay? Uh-huh. It's not certain that it is haram to make it najis. So he is of the view that there's no reason to indicate that it is haram to make it najis.
Thank you very much, Ajawi. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to talk about some of the jurisprudential laws related to praying in the mosque based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Thank you for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي المميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to RIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines this hour. U.S. police raid a protest camp at the University of California amid a crackdown on pro-Palestinian student protesters across the country. A major Muslim civil rights and advocacy group censures U.S. lawmakers for approving a bill aimed at criminalizing any criticism of Israel. And an international human rights organization says that Israel militarizes schools in Gaza, executing displaced people who seek refuge there. This is news. Thanks for joining us. U.S. police have stormed a protest encampment at the University of California amid similar crackdown on pro-Palestine sit-ins on other campuses in the country. The police made several arrests as the protesting students had defied the warning that they either disperse or face detention. Protest is part of a divestment movement in the U.S. and other countries. Pro-Palestine students demand authorities in their respective universities to stop financial ties with companies that have linked with the Israeli regime. They also want an end to the ongoing Israeli genocide in Gaza. Clashes have also been reported at other American universities. Earlier, scuffles broke out between protesters and police at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. At New York's Fordham University, protesters chanted anti-Israeli slogans and waved Palestinian flags under heavy police presence. More than 1,500 protesters have been arrested at colleges across the U.S.